From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The news is full of stories lately of what is or can certainly look like police overkill, from New York to South Carolina, to an Ohio Walmart, to Ferguson, Missouri, and Los Angeles. It's not a new story, but these vivid stories have put policing and race and attitudes and training front and center, with a call for change and body cameras all over. A policeman also shot this weekend in Ferguson. This hour, On Point Police and Policing in America. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's going on? How do we fix it? Police officers, why do we keep hearing, seeing these stories? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from St. Louis, Missouri, is David Klinger, professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, a senior research fellow at the Police Foundation, works to improve American policing. David Klinger, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
From New York, Gloria Brown Marshall joins us, professor in the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, where she is also professor of constitutional law, author of Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to present. That's a swath. Gloria Brown Marshall, thank you for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And from Irvine, California, Jeff Ward, professor of criminology, law, and society, and sociology at the University of California, Irvine, author of The Black Child Savers. Jeff Ward, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom.
There's so much to look at here. I want to start just with going through a series of tapes and getting the response of all three of you to this, because this is what people are seeing in the media, and it's come to feel kind of like a torrent lately. This was just last week, Lance Corporal Sean Grubert, South Carolina State Trooper, arrested and charged with assault and battery for shooting an unarmed man at a gas station. Everybody by now, or many people, will have seen this on TV or heard this on the radio, but the man he stopped there, LeVar Jones, turns around, to my eye, does not look particularly menacing. The officer asks him for his license. LeVar Jones reaches into his SUV, like into the front seat or the middle console. Okay, can't see what's going on. But then you hear the bullets, and down he goes. And he's saying to the officer, "You said get my license. I grabbed my license. It's right here. Here's the tape."
"Can I see your license, please?" "Get out of the car! Get out of the car! Get on the ground! Get on the ground!"
"I just got my license. You said get my license. I grabbed my license right here. That's my license right there."
"Put your hands behind your back. Put your hands behind your back. Put your hands behind your back.
I just got my license. You said get my license. I grabbed my license. It's right there." White policeman, black man down. He survives, but all those shots. David Klinger, let me bring this one to you. We want to talk much more broadly, but people have seen this, and it's just shocking. What do you say to it? Is that a civilian's view? Is there something right that went on here? I can't see it.
I don't see anything right, and I think the problem is it starts before the camera picks up the officer coming into view, because what happens if you see it is the officer moves across the face of his patrol car. There's a real simple way to avoid this, and that is instead of saying, "Let me see your driver's license, please," when someone's out of the vehicle, you say, "Sir, do you have a driver's license?" And then that person says, "Yes." And then you say, "Where is it?"
Mm-hmm.
And then if he says, "It's in the vehicle," then you can say, "Okay, sir, what I want you to do is slowly reach into the vehicle." And what you do is you stay on the other side of your patrol car so you have the engine block between yourself and the suspect, and then it's not a big issue. So what happens here, a complete misread by this officer, and I'm just glad that he's a bad shot.
He's facing potentially 20 years in jail for this. You're right. A lot of fire there. The man hit once in the hip. Gloria Brown Marshall, how do you interpret this video that everybody has seen now?
Well, I played that video yesterday in my class, and I want to go back a little further. When you listen to it, the officer says to the man who asked, "Why did you stop me?" And he said, "Well, you didn't have a seatbelt on." He said, "I just took it off when I pulled into the gas station."
Yeah.
So when we start looking at the relationship, the suspicion was already there. It was almost as though the officer wanted to stop the man anyway, found a reason to stop him, already thought he was going to be suspected of something horrible that would require, you know, an upper level of force.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just all of the rest of it becomes inevitable. And we can say, "Oh, that's great that he's alive," but he's traumatized for life.
Jeff Ward.
I disagree with your assessment, ma'am.
You disagree that there was opening suspicion that would hear
no,
David
Klinger? What she said is it's inevitable. The vast, vast majority of situations where police officers stop people, and Ms. Brown Marshall knows this quite well, do not result in deadly force or, in fact, any form of force. And to say that it's inevitable is a huge overreach, ma'am.
Inevitable. Well, Gloria, do you mean the shooting was inevitable here?
When the officer started to interact, the inevitability I'm speaking to is one of heightened aggression. When he stopped the man in the first place, he said, I stopped you because you didn't have on a seatbelt. So they're looking for something in the first place that's going to lead.
But that's their job.
But their job is
the click it or ticket mantra is all across the country, ma'am.
Click it or ticket. So put the seatbelt in. But the guy's pulling into a gas station.
Well, I think it's a foolish law. I think that what it does is it creates situations like this where officers stop people for really no reason.
David Klinger, let us hold that thought. But I wonder. Sure. I do want to come back to it because it's fundamentally important.
I think it's a diversion.
Gloria is saying there's a fundamental attitude here. It's not hard to hear in what Gloria is saying that it may go back to race. And I want to bookmark that and fully come back to it. Jeff Ward, in this tape. I've watched it many times now. When the man is getting out of his SUV, to me, now I'm a civilian, I'm not a policeman, I'm not trained, but he does not look menacing to me. Am I missing something, Jeff?
Well, I think, I would agree it was clearly poor policing practice, not being a policing expert. But I think what's clear from this instance and all of these others, really, is that the willingness to engage in lethal violence is there in a way that it just wouldn't be. If you think about, if you modify the characteristics of the victim in this case, imagine a woman who's not African-American or who's white in particular.
Yep.
Imagine an older person or a much younger person. You can easily imagine that even with all of the tactical issues that have been discussed and the problematic law, this wouldn't have ended in a potentially deadly shooting. So I think what was so fearsome there was, according to some of the research I'm familiar with, there's a kind of automatic association between African-American men in particular and risk or crime and danger. And I think we saw that play out in this police officer's shooting of that innocent man.
We'll dig into that here and across the country. One more piece of tape. This was August 5th. Police officer shot and killed a man. This was John Crawford III in an Ohio Walmart. According to police, he was waving an air rifle. He had picked it up off a shelf at the store. It was a BB gun. It was for sale in the Walmart. The police said he didn't obey their commands. Police department has promised complete transparency in an investigation. They released a 911 audio and surveillance video footage. Here's the 911 audio.
Sir, what's going on?
Gunshots in the store.
Hey, what's your order? Or
police officers are here. They're on the scene.
All right.
I just had any shots fired. Start an ambulance.
Start an ambulance. Shot down and dead. Here's John Crawford II, his father, talking to the media after learning that the police officer who shot his son in the Walmart would not be indicted by a grand jury.
The family and I are in shock and disbelief that a young man could go inside of a store and be a patron and not come out alive.
Go in as a patron and not come out alive. David Klinger, years ago, I went into a store and bought a BB gun for my son. I came out alive. What happened here? I watched the video, a little bit of it. I didn't see it all. He did not look menacing to me. He looked like a guy carrying a BB gun over his shoulder, having a little fun. He's dead.
It's a tragedy, but in this situation, the officers did absolutely nothing wrong. You get a call as a police officer that someone is pointing a firearm at children, which is what the officers were told. One of the officers checked back and said, are you sure that he was pointing it and he just doesn't have it? He was told, yes, the report is pointing a gun. Officers go in. This is something that officers have been trained in since Columbine, called rapid reaction or active shooter training. Officers come in, give verbal commands. Suspect doesn't comply. The weapon moves. The officers shoot. They really don't have any other option.
They sell BB guns at Walmart. You know,
so they sell real guns at real gun stores. And if someone is wandering around with a gun, a police officer doesn't know.
Gloria,
and that's the problem.
Gloria, what do you say here?
I say on August 19th, William Elders in Platt County, Missouri, was waving a rifle at cars passing by on the highway. Police arrived. He would not put down the rifle. He pointed it at them. They tased him. He's a white male, 46 years old. That same day in St. Louis, a mentally disturbed black man is on a street in St. Louis with a small knife. He doesn't put down the knife. He's shot several times. What we look at is how policing reacts to the person, with more incidents of these deadly force situations happening when there's an African-American male. And whether or not, going back to the other point, whether or not it's click it or ticket or stop and frisk or whatever it's called, the systems that are put in place are used more aggressively when it comes to people of color. And then at the end of the day, it too often, when there is some sign of aggression, it rises to lethal force more often with black Americans, disproportionately to their relationship to law enforcement. Law enforcement is interacting with people all the time, as was pointed out. But when they interact with people of color, unfortunately, too often it ends in deadly force.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about police shootings, police culture, training, body cameras, and how to protect the public and the police. Gloria Brown Marshall is with us from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Jeff Ward is here, University of California, Irvine. David Klinger, University of Missouri, St. Louis. It's not as if police are held harmless in this. It's not as if they're not vulnerable. On just this Saturday night in Ferguson, a police officer shot in the arm by a man attempting apparently to burglarize the town community center. At a press conference on Sunday, St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar said the shooting was unrelated to the protests over Michael Brown's shooting death in Ferguson in August.
It didn't happen within the proximity of the protest area. This is an area that's fairly secluded, and I wouldn't have any reason to believe right now that it was linked in any way, shape, manner, or form with the protest. It certainly doesn't appear that way.
Jeff Ward, you follow the numbers here. What do the numbers show over time about police violence, violence against American citizens, against citizens of color?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have data on all police interactions with the public, and so the numbers that we have are limited in that sense. But it's very clear historically that that there's a constant issue of police violence directed at African Americans and likely other groups as well. We've been collecting data here on civil rights era racial violence. That is violence from the 1950s to mid-1970s. And of the over 2,000 incidents that we've identified so far, these are instances of violence, intimidation, reprisal directed at people engaged in the civil rights movement. I would say that about a third to half of the incidents involve police officers or other legal officials.
Isn't that a different realm involved in the civil rights movement? That's different, isn't it, from burglarizing a community center potentially or a corner store or, you know, lots of other.
Oh, sure. But my point, well, yeah, it is. And these were also typically people engaged in lawful protest or in many instances, not protest at all. They were simply in violation of the racial etiquette. They were seen as being disrespectful to officers. You know, they spoke back. They didn't say, sir. And this was, you know, this was in a different time. But my point is that that the events today are not disconnected from a long story of racial violence in the United States that involves police officers. I don't think we've had a conversation nationally about that story, and so we're not very well aware of all the interconnections over time and the extent of the problem. But it's clear that there is a long history to what we're seeing today. And I just add one thing, you know, one of the novelties of the issue today is that there are so many cameras, whether they're dashboard cameras or smartphones, and there's the internet. And so we are more likely to be aware of instances today in a way that we weren't just 20, 30 years ago. So we have the impression that this is a rash of events, but really if you look at any year in that, in particularly in the 60s, 50s, 40s, you would find a lot of these rashes of events.
David Klinger, Jeff Ward sees a constant level of violence, or constant over time. That's not exactly reassuring from the impressions we get over this last summer in particular. How do you look at all these images which have been in front of us in the Walmart, in South Carolina, by the road in Los Angeles, on and on? Is this just more cameras out there, David, or do we have a rising problem here?
Well, I think the data, and I Mr. Ward is talking about another era, and he said that, and I don't think he's making an argument that things are constant. For example, if we look between the 1970s and the 2000s in both New York and Los Angeles, in terms of officer-involved shootings, a number of times that police officers in those two cities shoot people, far fewer in the last decade than in the 1970s. There was a spike in the 90s with the cocaine cowboys and whatnot. But violence, at least as measured by police use of deadly force, is down in our two biggest cities. And so what I think is there has always been a problem in the United States, and that problem is that the polity demands crime control at the same time demanding limited government power. And so we've got these constant there has been this constant friction. And unfortunately, as the two other guests have pointed out, sometimes this gets played out in a racial fashion. And when it's played out in a racial fashion, we need to condemn it. But at the same time, we can't put race into something when it's not there.
You say there's a problem with crime control and limited government power, but you're really just talking about the U.S. Constitution. That's the idea of this country.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, is that a problem? I mean, that surely
What I mean by problem is that creates the sense constant across Americans. Cops don't even like cops. If you talk to police officers about internal affairs, they don't like internal affairs. People don't like being stopped by the police. People don't like being challenged by the police. That is part of our birthright. And so when we talk about the conflict between police and the public, it is broader than white versus black. That's the point I'm trying to make.
But not wanting to be stopped by police is surely different than not wanting to be killed, not wanting to be overzealously the subject of deadly force.
Right, but I'm missing your point, sir.
Let me just hold it. Gloria Brown Marshall, what do you think's going on here? We see all this on the TV. We hear about it on the radio. Do we have a surge in a problem? Is it a constant? What's happening?
I think there's been a constant thread throughout American history that actually was part of the post-Civil War era of the Black Codes, where criminal laws were created in order to harass and incarcerate the newly freed African Americans. And that went into the convict lease system and the loitering laws, trespass laws, et cetera, and into the time period in which we were just speaking about the civil rights era, because they were considered criminals. What they were doing in many cases, not just against the etiquette, but in sitting in those restaurants, they were violating the law because the law was segregation at the time. So as we move into the riots of the 1960s and 70s, we still have these tensions between police officers, and many of those riots, for example, the Newark riots and other riots, were caused by interactions with police officers that led to the riots in cities like Newark. So those things have been a constant. They have not been addressed. When we get to Rodney King, we have commissions. We've always had commissions, and they study it, and they say there's a lack of opportunity, there's a high level of friction between officers in the Black community, and then things kind of go, they're quelled a little bit. But there's always that simmering tension beneath the surface. And it was summed up at a conference I attended at the Brennan Center on Tuesday of last week, where U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder spoke. But one of the officers, commissioners of police in Baltimore said police officers, many of them believe they are upholding the status quo, that that's part of their job, that they're doing God's work, upholding the status quo.
By which they mean what? The status quo meaning what?
The status quo and the way it was spoken, because this was during a time period we were discussing race and policing at that particular criminal justice conference. And the idea of the status quo, I say in my book, Race, Law, and American Society, there's a socio-racial hierarchy. There are certain people who are supposed to be in their place. And once they show this obstinance, once they're arrogant, once they're uppity or anything, it's like we have to maintain the status quo, that certain people are supposed to be certain places. And we've never really addressed the race issue in this country. We haven't had a truth and reconciliation commission. We haven't really addressed it. We pick around the edges, but we won't go to the heart of it.
Boy, that gets so big, it's hard to know how to get our hands around it. But when we see these videos and hear them, it's clear that it's not just okay. I want to look at fixes. I want to hear from our listeners. There are a lot waiting to talk with all three of you. David, Gloria, Jeff, Gabriel is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Gabriel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I wanted to speak today because today's issue kind of touched very close to home with me. Growing up, I've always had educators and counselors and anyone who was an influence in my life kind of tell me to be weary of authority and kind of always question it. But I never would say anyone would have told me that in sort of a way that was anarchistic or anything that would be considered okay. You know, wrong or revolutionary to any degree. And I mean, personally, myself, at 9 years old, I had police officers slam me against the hood of a car coming back from a birthday party, not but two houses down from where I live. My friends, my family, my neighbors could see. My brother was visibly upset when he saw that.
Why do you think that happened? Why do you think that happened, Gabriel?
Honestly, the only thing that I can consider, I mean, and this continues to happen to me, is that I'm a black male in America, and I hate to think that there's a tie-in between race and the escalation of violence or the escalation of force with police officers. But I mean, statistically, when you look at it, you have to. The numbers don't lie. I mean, you can have one person in the same state, going to Missouri, mm-hmm. when Mike Brown was shot, he laid out in the street for hours. There's another gentleman in Missouri who physically attacked police officers, broke a police officer's hand while breaking into someone's home, and you know, this man was arrested. Was this man black? No, he was white. It doesn't even make me wonder at this point. At this point, the statistics themselves have solidified my belief that if you are a black man in this country, you're, for lack of a better word, a target for police and police force.
Gabriel, stand by. David Klinger in St. Louis, you hear Gabriel's kind of testimony there, a witness out of Rhode Island. Just lost another caller here, but from outside Chicago, saying police have to enforce the law. It's not easy. Lay off. But if our caller Gabriel is right, and he's kind of seconding what we've heard from Gloria, it sounds like a big problem, David.
I agree that there are problems. There's no doubt about it. And for a police officer to slam a 9-year-old into a motor vehicle, a squad car, makes absolutely no sense. So if that's what happened, that was wrong. If the officers have racial animus in their heart, they don't belong on the job. I mean, that's pretty basic. But when Gabe was talking about the notion of data, as Professor Ward mentioned, the data that we have is not very good. But what limited data we do have across the country indicates that most of the people killed by police bullets are white.
Well, I guess there are many more white people. Jeff Ward, do you have any numbers on that? Or Gloria, do you have numbers that will help us here?
I think you were saying there are many more white people. The disproportionate number of black people killed by police is, I think, the issue. And the disparity when it comes mm-hmm. to how police interact with whites as opposed to blacks. I mean, when I think about the black woman who was actually having a nervous breakdown in Washington, D.C., and ran into the fence at the White House, and is shot in her car, and we have a white man running across the White House lawn into the White House who lives to tell the story. What is going on when we come to how we I mean, even the black man in the White House doesn't get the same police protection as black people. You know, generally, I mean, as white people, when you think generally, you know, black people not only are not getting the police protection in a way because now it's fearful. You're fearful to even call the police because you don't know what the reaction is going to be. I'll give this anecdotal story. My husband was in his mother's apartment building. A strange man was walking around and he called the police. The police tried to put him against the wall. My husband is an accountant wearing a suit. And it was just a horrible situation to the point where he said, next time I don't even know if I'll call the police. Maybe I'll just have to handle it myself. There is just this heightened insecurity and also this sense of just concern that Gabriel has pointed out. So where do we go if we can't use the police? Then where do we go from here? What do we do? You were talking about fixes, and I think that is something that needs to be discussed.
Let me go first to Kyle, Texas. Tiago is calling. Tiago, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Tom. Hi. So I'm calling today because I think we need to go back. I mean, I know that we were saying that some whites and some blacks took them to get shot by the police. But I've talked to a lot of people that actually train these police officers, you know, people that are engaged on actually bringing these officers to the forces. And what they say is that is, for the most part, is what's wrong is how we actually train them. We have been training them to, and again, I'll speak to the next, is that we have been training them in a way where they readily associate the presence of a weapon to the escalation force to death. Now, they don't take the extra second to think, wait, is there actually a weapon there? Also, you know, that speaks volumes to what we have done. We have asked, we have created this norm where they associate, that we associate firearms with, you know, automatically, we are afraid of it. We create this absolutely hopeful environment where if there's a weapon or the perception of a weapon, that we absolutely go into this almost irrational thinking.
Well, I mean, a weapon is certainly can be dangerous, but then how do we handle it? And how do we handle it across the whole spectrum of Americans? Tiago, I appreciate your call. David Klinger, what about training? Are there steps that could be taken there to push, surely there are, to push back on whether it's a surge or whether it's a constant, to make policing better, fairer, safer for American citizens?
Absolutely. And the point that I was trying to make about how the South Carolina trooper handled the traffic stop, there are very small things that police officers can do during interactions with citizens to reduce the likelihood of violence. One of the fathers of all of this type of research, a guy named James Fife, who unfortunately passed away several years ago, talked and wrote about this. And what we know is that when police officers have the opportunity by either taking cover or through some other process of not feeling as much fear because they're not out in the open, it does give them that extra little bit of time that the caller just mentioned. And so what police officers need to be trained to do is to think with foresight, to say, when I make this traffic stop, what possibly could happen? And I need to be prepared for all of them, everything from the guy reaching into his vehicle to get a gun to the guy reaching into his vehicle to get his driver's license. And if you structure your stops appropriately, then an awful lot of this goes away. Now, the other thing is there are some police officers that simply shouldn't be on the job. So what I'm distinguishing is
because why? Officers why, making David?
Because they're brutal. Because they either are badge heavy coming into the job or they become badge heavy. And badge heavy meaning I think that I have the power because mm-hmm. I'm a cop, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so there's a difference between brutality, where a police officer willfully, maliciously goes out and hurts somebody, versus a police officer who makes a mistake tactically, panics, and then either uses deadly force or a lesser form of force out of fear that is unreasonable.
Gloria, is this about tactical training? Is this about personality assessment? Is this about a bigger structure? You're talking about enforcing a status quo racial hierarchy.
Well, here's the thing. One thing I really like about – there are many things, but one thing I really like about my college, John Jay College, is that James Fife was there. So he was also somebody I interacted with regarding police training. And training is one part of it, but it's also – you have to train the person who walks through that room. And that means at John Jay, we have race and law classes where we actually talk to police officers through their training about the racial history in this country. And I think that's important to add to any training police officers receive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about police shootings, police culture, training, body cameras, and how to protect the public, all the public, and the police in American law enforcement. A rash of situations in the last several months just makes it seem like a surge of overkill. There have been problems for a long time, and they have not gone away. David Klinger is with us today, University of Missouri, St. Louis, to help us look at this. Jeff Ward, University of California, Irvine. Gloria Brown Marshall, John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Ferguson, Missouri, put all this on the map in August when the town just went up in arms, sometimes in flames, after the killing of Michael Brown. On August 15th, and people had waited a long time for this, Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson finally released the name of the officer who had shot and killed Michael Brown, Darren Wilson, and responded to questions about his disciplinary history on the force.
He was a gentleman. He's a quiet officer, and he has been an excellent officer for the police department.
How has he been affected by this?
It's devastating, absolutely devastating. He never intended for any of this to happen.
A gentleman, a quiet officer, last week an apology for how long Michael Brown's body lay in the street. It was deeply disturbing to people there in Ferguson. Said they needed time for the investigation, but there was an apology. Michael Brown's parents, with the Associated Press talking on Saturday, his dad, Michael Brown Sr., saying that he and his wife were unmoved by that public apology.
The apology will be when Darren Wilson has handcuffs, process, and charged with murder.
In handcuffs, charged with murder. And sometimes children just speak from the heart and tell us truths. CBS's Jane Pauley talked with 11-year-old Marquis Govan. This was September 21st. He had made a speech about racial tensions in Ferguson to the St. Louis County Council in August.
We need more African-American police officers.
But who in your school aspires to grow up and be a cop?
Look, let me tell you why.
Anybody?
No, let me tell you why this. From the beginning, we felt abused by these people. Why would you go up to serve among the abusers? It doesn't make any sense.
The voice, the mind at work of 11-year-old Marquis Govan. And clearly, there's a problem here. We've got tons of response on this. And I want to go to one of our listeners in particular who's just all over this with all three of you. Dear guest, Michael Johnson is writing to us. And he says, "You know, this, Tom, this is probably one of the most important topics in America today. So if you think this is important, you may think it's very important." And he's got a whole list of things that need to be done. Number one, end the war on drugs, this listener says. Treat it as a sickness rather than an offense. America has one of the highest incarceration rates per capita as a direct result on that of that war. Two, cameras on cops, on duty, all the time, without exception. And serious charges for police who don't have those working. Three, hold police personally and financially accountable for their actions. Four, demilitarize the police and the use of SWAT tactics for a majority of situations. Five, teach conflict de-escalation. Six, transparent accountability. No more internal investigations, no more withholding data. But get a transparent accountability going on here. David Klinger, what do you make of that list?
I agree with just about everything. I think, however, the issue of body cameras 100% of the time, it's going to take a little bit of time for us to figure out how to use the body cameras.
Why?
Because people do have privacy rights. If you and I are on patrol and we respond to, let's say, a domestic dispute, what right does the public have to see what goes on when we respond and there is no criminal activity, we decide not to arrest anybody?
Well,
in their
the
own
police
home.
Will see it if it stays within police circles.
Right. But one of the things that happened here in St. Louis is hackers got into the Ferguson Police Department personnel stuff, put out a bunch of information about where officers live, so on and so forth. Trust me, once it's on video, it is not going to be completely private. And so I am a big fan of body cameras. But what I'm saying is we have to figure out exactly how to use them appropriately. And a couple of researchers out in Arizona, Mike White and Justin Reedy, have been working with the Mesa Police Department with a they've actually been doing research out there trying to figure out just how to make it work properly. But no, I'm a big fan of that. I've been writing for years that we need to call off the hounds when it comes to the drug war, so on and so forth.
Let me go to that one with Gloria Brown Marshall first. Gloria, body cameras, how effective do you think they'd be?
I think that they would be very effective. I think it's necessary for officers to use these videos also for training purposes, see what went wrong and what went right, so they can actually have like live experiences to help them better understand what they could do to improve race relations, improve their relationship with the community.
If they're not on 100% of the time, how can we be sure that they're not, you know, turned off, oops, just when the trouble starts?
And I think they, unfortunately, I see the privacy issue in teaching constitutional law, and I'm a big person, I'm a big advocate for privacy issues. But I think that it's important under this circumstance, when a person is inviting the police into their home, they're inviting the government into their home. When the government enters, I think having that camera on is very necessary because that government person, that officer, is the witness. So they're going to write up reports. They're going to do a number of things. But in looking at the technology that's necessary in order to protect the video, it's something that needs to be a focus of investment. But I think 100% of the time the cameras must be on. Given the lack of trust between the community and the police right now, I think it's essential for those cameras to be on 100% of the time.
I want to come back to the rest of our listener, Michael Johnson's list, but a couple of calls for Scott in Austin, Texas. Scott, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Yes, Tom. I just wanted to point out the elephant in the room to some degree, that the African-American population takes up about 25% of America's population, but it does account for roughly 75% of the violent crime in America. And until that is addressed, until that dynamic has changed, there'll always be a police bias towards targeting the African population. I myself am married to a black woman, so it's not a racial thing for me, but I just call it like I see it.
Hang on, Scott. I thought the African-American population was something more like 12-13% overall. I don't know these numbers. Gloria, what about this? 75% of violent crime, African-Americans? Is that accurate?
Well, here's the thing. We have statistics based on police interaction. So we have a 13% to 14% of the population African-American. And the arrests and convictions and incarceration, of course, is 3 and sometimes 4 times that. So I agree with the caller when it comes to the disproportionality of the criminality that African-Americans are accused of doing and convicted. But I do have a concern about the assumption that in that interaction, there aren't times, many times, that police officers decide to resolve an issue that involves a person who is white as a suspect in a way that does not lead to arrest and so therefore does not lead to convictions, et cetera. My major concern is when we look at what white behavior is when it comes to criminal justice, it inures to the individual. When we look at what black behavior is, it's to the whole group. So we don't say Adam Lanza as a white male is acting out in a way all white males would act out. We say that he had an individual problem. He did this horrible deed. But so much of criminality is the nurse to the whole African-American group in a way that has made this criminality or this sense of violence more of an African-American problem than it is for any other racial group.
Scott in Austin, let me ask you, what about the drug war role in all of this? And the some would assume that it has essentially criminalized a whole community here, and that's part of the reason you've got those numbers.
Well, I certainly partly agree with that, for sure. I mean, the drug policies in America have caused a lot of minority, you know, ethnicities to be unjustly put into prison disproportionately. But I'm focusing more on violent crime, not drug dealing per se, but shootings, robberies, rapes, murders.
But of course, a lot of violent crime is related to the drug war. But Scott, we take your point. I'm glad you raised it just that plainly. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Bridget in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Bridget, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think, Bridget?
So here's my question. And first, let me just say, my father was a police officer for 30 years.
Okay.
And he walked the beat. He got to know the neighborhood. So my question is, where has that kind of community policing gone, where it's not immediately reaching for the handgun, but talking to the neighborhood, getting to know the people? And I'll take my question off the air.
Bridget, I appreciate your call. Walking the beat. David Klinger, what about it?
I think that's a great idea, and there's opportunities to communicate with people more effectively, but walking the beat per se in our modern society where motor vehicles are the primary mode of transportation, and that's what police have worked for. So what I would argue for is absolutely get out of your car when you can, get to know people, talk to shopkeepers, talk to the people outside the shops, build those relationships. But walking a beat per se is problematic in most places. There are places where it can be done and it should be done.
But Gloria, what about our young Marquis Govan in St. Louis saying, you know, you need more African-American police officers if you're – we saw this in Ferguson very heavily. If you're sort of importing police officers, what's the dynamic? Are they going to want to walk the beat? It's not even their turf.
Well, actually, one does. This is a great thing about policing. Police officers, for the most part, want to help people. That's why they went into policing. It's an honorable profession. But we have a number of things that are happening. We have this sense of fear when it comes to policing now, that it is the worst job when it comes to losing one's life, et cetera, and the chances are horrible
that
something bad's going to happen. Actually, a logger, a fisherman, roofer, sanitation workers, coal miners, truck drivers, and construction workers have more dangerous jobs.
Okay.
When it comes to OSHA statistics. But Of course, the police officer is more visible because he's also or she is also a representative of the government. When something happens, it's a horrible thing. It makes more news. And when we look at a police officer being injured, it is something that brings things to a higher proportion than it would for someone who's injured in a construction accident. And there are many more facets to it.
But what about having officers out of the community that they're operating in? Our young speaker there, 11 years old, says people aren't going to want to do it there because, you know, they don't have a positive opinion of the police force. Is it important anyway, Gloria, to somehow figure that out?
It's very important because in Ferguson, 53 officers, three of whom are black, in a community that's 70% black. I mean, it was almost like apartheid South Africa in this small town. And I have to, out of all honesty, say that having grown up in the Midwest, the civil rights movement was slow to reach it. And by the time it did, it kind of petered out. So the Midwest didn't get the same intensity under the microscope that the South and the Northeast and other places received. But I think it's important. Walking the beat, I think, is important to get to know your community, the reduced militarization of police, and of course this whole sense that if there is some diversity training, maybe you'll see the person with whom you're interacting as a person and not start off thinking this person is going to hurt me, and so therefore I have to have heightened aggression in that interaction.
Sue in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Sue, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point is, my brother was involved about 40 years ago in a program for high school boys in Maryland. They were taken to the police academy to find out what policing involved. And the process then was that a police officer would shoot to wound if he had to shoot. And later that was changed to shooting to kill. The thinking was that you would be less likely to use that weapon if you knew you were using it with lethal force. But since people can't really be told not to be afraid or told that they shouldn't have racial biases they might not even be fully conscious of, it makes sense to me to go back to the shoot-to-wound approach.
Sue, let us pick it up right there. Our time is short. David Klinger, where does that stand today in the South Carolina confrontation? I mean, there were a lot of shots there. How many? Four? Five? You say it's just lucky he was a bad shot. It didn't seem like shooting to wound. He was wounded in the end, but four or five shots.
Police officers don't shoot to wound. They don't shoot to kill. They shoot to stop the threat. It's very simple. Unfortunately, the way that police officers are trained, and it has to be this way, is officers shoot for center mass, and that's basically, you know, the middle of your chest, yep, your xiphoid, yep, process, whatever. And so consequently, that's where you're more likely to have serious wounds and deaths. But that's the only way to stop people. The issue
has that changed over time? Our caller Sue says she believes it has since her brother was young.
I would argue that unfortunately her memory is either mistaken or she got bad information. There's never been a notion of shoot to wound. In fact, I'm sure that Professor Brown Marshall is aware of this, that the courts have ruled that you can't, as a police officer, say, oh, I was trying to shoot the gun out of their hand and accidentally hit him in the head, so therefore, it's okay. No, either deadly force is appropriate or it's inappropriate. And so it's always been shoot to stop. And I was a cop 33 years ago. That's what I was trained in, and that's how it's always been as far as I'm aware.
Gloria, do you see more aggressive use of firearms here? I mean, we're also talking about militarization. We saw police in Ferguson, you know, aiming high-powered rifles out at masses of people who were protesting in the street. Do you see more aggressive use of firearms?
I see more aggressive use of firearms. I see police officers who are not in the best physical condition. I don't know what happened to that, and maybe they feel they need to rely more on their weapons. What was raised before was dispute resolution and the, mm-hmm, and the fact that dispute resolution has not really been practiced. It was a way for a short time in the late 80s and early 90s and then kind of petered out. I'm looking at equal opportunity deadly force. If what we are going to have in this country, in this great democracy, is the use of deadly force on a regular basis, then let's have it be equal opportunity deadly force and not get used to bad things happening to black people. And that's what's happened right now, from my perspective.
Jeff Ward,
what's interesting on that point,
yes,
is that all of the research that I'm aware of indicates that police officers essentially do what Professor Brown Marshall is arguing for. For example, both of us know Jim Fife quite well, and his dissertation was the groundbreaking dissertation, groundbreaking research in police use of deadly force. He looked at all shootings in New York City in the early 1970s. And to make a very long story short, it turned out that black officers were more likely to shoot than white officers. And at first you go, holy mackerel, there's something wrong with the black cops. But what Jim was able to do is he was able to disaggregate that and look at assignments and where people lived. And it showed that police officers who work high crime areas are the officers that tend to shoot. More black officers were assigned to high crime areas. And a sizable chunk of police shootings happen when officers are off duty. Black officers tended to live in higher crime areas and therefore were involved in more shootings.
David, our time is so short here. I appreciate it. We've got that. Jeff Ward, I want to give you the last word. You've been sidelined for a minute here. I mean, these videos just seem to keep coming. We've got citizens' lives at stake. We've got sort of social unity or cohesion at stake. We've got a global reputation at stake. People are watching these around the world and they're seeing black Americans, you know, who seem in the gun sights here. Are we moving? Do you think we'll move more aggressively toward solving this, Jeff?
Well, I hope so. I want to go back to something that Gloria said.
20 seconds, Jeff.
Sure. And that is that, you know, we need to step back beyond the focus on police, even beyond the issue of shooting, and think about a national conversation on where we have been in terms of racial violence generally and police violence in particular, because we need a change in political culture. And that won't come from cameras, that won't come from sensitivity training, it will come from a more elaborate process of engagement.
Well, you've been all kind enough to help us have a little piece of that conversation right here, and we will keep it going. Jeff Ward in California, David Klinger in St. Louis, Gloria Brown Marshall in New York. Our thanks to all of you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.